This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And other electronic devices can cause serious illness, according to some global health professionals. Health officials across Europe and elsewhere are currently expanding research and tightening regulation of these invisible environmental pollutants. Residents of populated areas are exposed to increasing levels of EMF and RF radiation as the telecommunications industry grows and the number of wireless devices and networks increases. People who are sensitive exhibit symptoms ranging from headaches and tingling skin to more serious loss of motor function. Other electrosensitivity symptoms include chronic pain, memory loss, disturbed sleep, depression, and digestive disorders. KBOO's Andrew Geller will host a call-in program on wireless radiation and its health effects this Monday morning at 8 o'clock.
A Canadian company filed federal applications for a proposed $7 billion liquefied natural gas export terminal in Coos Bay. The Jordan Cove Energy Project would include a 230-mile supply pipeline, a cooling facility, and a gas-fired power plant to support the facility. The facility would potentially be the largest ever construction project in Oregon. It would transport natural gas from the Rockies to Asia. One of the hurdles Versen Incorporated, a Calgary-based company, faces is getting federal permits to ship to countries that don't have free trade agreements with the U.S., such as Japan and Korea. The company considers this week's filing with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission as a milestone after 8 years of seeking approval, initially as an import facility. Developers say they have all their local land use approvals, but the pipeline still needs to be approved by Coos and Douglas counties. Various state and federal agencies will need to assess the project's compliance with clean air, clean water, coastal zone management, and endangered species regulation. Senator Ron Wyden, chair of the Senate's Energy Committee, is skeptical of the project because of the potential economic impacts of exporting natural gas.
A coalition of environmental groups filed a formal petition with the Army Corps of Engineers earlier this week after a year of informal requests to study the impact proposed coal exports have failed to yield a response. Combined, the three proposed sites in Oregon and Washington would see up to 100 million tons of Powder River Basin coal transversing the region at a rate of as many as 40 coal trains per day at a mile and a half long each. More than 500 businesses, 160 elected officials, including the governors of both states, cite a lengthy list about the potential for damage to public health and safety that such an increase in rail traffic might pose. Earth Justice is the organization that officially filed the petition, and other groups include Power Past Coal, the Sierra Club, and Physicians for Social Responsibility.
According to the Associated Press, six Oregon universities will increase their tuition by 5% next year. A committee for the State Board of Higher Education passed the motion today to advance the proposed tuition increase to review under the entire board in June. Taking 12 credits at Portland State will cost roughly $2,100 a term, not including school books, a parking pass, or other additional class fees. Universities say the increases are due to the lack of state support, as well as the increase of health care and retirement costs. The Oregon House recently approved a bill to allow community colleges to create programs that compete with offerings from career colleges. Supporters of the bill suggest it will create a level playing field to compete with public colleges. However, community colleges fear the new bill will restrict their ability to create new public programs that help train students for fields such as nursing or truck driving. The restriction has also ensured fewer class offerings, especially in healthcare fields. Governor John Kitzhaber has yet to officially sign the bill. His spokesman Tim Raphael said he will most likely sign it.
Utah Army veteran Matthew David Stewart was found dead this Friday morning as he anticipated charges of attempted aggravated murder and marijuana cultivation. Stewart was discovered hanging from his jail bedsheet during routine cell check. Police authorities obtained a search warrant for a drug raid after receiving a tip from Stewart's ex-girlfriend that he was growing marijuana. Matthew stated he had never heard the officers identify themselves before they broke down the front door, which would be an illegal conduct on authority. Matthew has continued to maintain his story up until his death, saying it was self-defense since he thought he was getting robbed. Matthew's father, Michael Stewart, believes that police authorities illegally obtained a search warrant. His father declared, quote, "I think he gave up. He was depressed."
Yesterday, Drug Task Forces raided three medical marijuana establishments in southern Oregon, resulting in four arrests. The search and seizure operations in Medford follow a two-year investigation during which undercover detectives purchased marijuana. Among those arrested is activist Lori Duckworth, executive director of the Southern Oregon chapter of NORML, the Nationalist Organization of Marijuana Laws. Those arrested are charged with profiting from sale of cannabis in violation of Oregon's medical marijuana laws. In a separate but related event, police officers in Eugene arrested two women while executing a search warrant of their dispensary. These raids occur as Oregon lawmakers consider a bill that would legalize medical marijuana outlets. Portland's Bureau of Environmental Services reported two sewage releases into the Willamette River yesterday. The first sewage release was due to heavy rains causing the combined sewer runoff pipes to overflow. The second release was due to a grease-clogged pipe, which caused a public toilet to spill 24,000 gallons of untreated sewage into the river. KBOO's Joe Meyer spoke with Link Mann of Portland's Bureau of Environmental Services for The Scoop.
Portland's Big Pipe Project was completed in 2011 and has dramatically decreased the amount of untreated sewage we dump in the Willamette. As Link Mann of the Bureau of Environmental Services explains, we can still expect a few incidents a year.
Yesterday, we had a lot of rain. I think we had almost 1.2 inches of rain. So that created, early in the day, a CSO event, a combined sewer overflow event. We, as you know, completed a project in November 2011 to control combined sewer overflows to the Willamette River. That doesn't mean prevent. We're allowed an average of four overflows each winter and an average of one overflow every three summers. So this was our summer overflow. That happened early in the morning and lasted for about 3 hours, and then the rain subsided and that stopped. Later in the day, we also had a sanitary sewage release. The difference is it didn't come from a combined sewer, which combines stormwater runoff and sanitary sewage in the same pipe. This one was caused by a grease blockage along with heavy rain. This happened in the afternoon yesterday at Waterfront Park. A pipe in the street on NATO Parkway became too full, and sewage backed up through a toilet in a public restroom facility and flowed into a storm drain and on into the Willamette River. And the maintenance crews who responded to that and fixed it and cleared the pipe estimated that about 2,400 gallons of sewage went into the river.
When you say we're allowed a certain amount of overflows, who's allowing that?
The DEQ.
Probably some of my listeners, me included, thought the big pipe was going to take care of these problems.
The big pipe controls combined sewer overflows. It doesn't eliminate them. We have allowable overflows. As I said, we are allowed by our agreement with the DEQ to have no more than four overflows each winter, combined sewer overflows, and no more than one combined sewer overflow every third summer. So we built a tunnel system. We built large tunnels, big pipes, on both sides of the Willamette River. Those pipes eliminated 94% of the combined sewage that used to overflow to the Willamette River. We used to, before those pipes were active and they went into service, we had an average of 50 CSO events every year. It was something like 6 billion gallons a year. So four per winter on average and one every third summer is a far cry from 50 per year. So the control dramatically reduced the amount of combined sewage that can go to the river.
You know, we're all grateful for that, no doubt. Can you say something about the system? Aren't there two lines separate? Isn't there a line for rainwater and a line for poop?
Well, let's see here. A combined sewer system carries both kinds. It carries the type of sewage from your home when you're shower drains and when you flush your toilet, and it also carries stormwater runoff. So they go into the same pipe. What the big pipes do, they parallel the Willamette River, and those combined sewers drain into that big pipe. On the west side big pipe is 14 inches in diameter. It's about 3.5 miles long. On the east side of the river, the pipe is 6 miles long and 22 feet in diameter. That's because there's a lot more population that is served by a combined sewer on the east side of the river. So those pipes collect during heavy rainstorms, those big tunnels collect combined sewage, and it flows by gravity to a big pump station, sewage pump station on Swan Island. And that pump station pumps it over a rise and into another gravity sewer that takes it to our Columbia Boulevard wastewater treatment plant.
So would you say Big Pipe is doing what it's supposed to?
It's doing exactly what it's supposed to. It's operating exactly the way it was designed.
Is it generally safe to swim in the Willamette?
Yes, it is. Yeah, especially now. Especially now that we have our Willamette River CSO tunnel system operating. It hasn't been this clean in generations.
That was Link Mann of Portland's Bureau of Environmental Services. He reports that contact with the river is to be avoided after the few raw sewage overflows we can expect each year. Other than that, the Willamette is cleaner than it has been for generations and safe for swimming. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
An I-5 bridge over the Skagit River north of Seattle collapsed last night, causing injuries but no fatalities. But Washington State transportation officials say the collapse of the heavily used bridge raises the question of aging infrastructure and the need for immediate repairs of Washington bridges and highways. The truck which caused the collapse was overloaded with drilling equipment, but the company that owns the truck says it has a permit to cross that bridge. As millions of people around the country prepare to travel on U.S. highways during this holiday weekend, many will cross the 66,000 bridges that the federal government has identified as structurally deficient. The bridge that collapsed in Mount Vernon, Washington last night under the weight of an overloaded truck was not on the national list of structurally deficient bridges. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. We'll hear activist Jackie Sumel, prison inmate Herman Wallace, and their work calling attention to solitary confinement. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is a chance of showers with temperatures in the mid-60s through the weekend.
It's 5:17. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Anyone who says that America has lost its innovative edge in technology and manufacturing has not chugged a can of Bud recently. The buzz is back. Well, actually, Budweiser is no longer American. It's now a German outfit owned by InBev, the world's largest maker of suds. But picky. The brew crew overseeing the King of Beers knows what we American quaffers want in a can of beer. A new and improved can. Huh? Yes, says the Vice President of Innovation at Budweiser, we're consciously working to bring innovation to the packaging side of the beer market. He explains that you trend seekers are on the make for new things, so the corporation's container shapers have devised a bow tie can that kinks inward in the middle. How exciting is that? Plus, get ready to bust your beer gut. There are 8.5 fewer calories in the new can. How did they manage that? By magic, which is to say, trickery. The bow tie design allows the multi-billion-dollar brew kings to short you by putting almost an ounce less of beer per can than you got in the old standard 12-ouncer. But come on, we experienced hoisters of the brewer's art will definitely feel that loss of product, so they can't fool us into paying more for less. Well, that's where their innovative genius trumps our consumer instincts. To keep us off balance, Anheuser-Busch InBev's Bowtie can has nearly double the amount of aluminum of its regular can, making the new feel just as heavy as the old. Less beer, more metal. That's heavy innovation, my friends. Oh, one more innovative twist. In case some of you trend seekers try to compare ounces in the new six packs, you will find that the bow tie cans only come in eight packs. This is Jim Hightower saying, if you want honest beer, try the craft brews at your local pub.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Although the Boy Scouts of America voted yesterday to allow openly gay boys to be scouts, some groups say the decision does not go far enough. Gay adults are still prohibited from being scoutmasters, and all scouts must still profess belief in God. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Lauren Anderson Youngblood with the Secular Coalition for America.
And I wonder if you could comment on the Boy Scout of America's decision yesterday to allow gay Boy Scouts.
Well, we think it's a step in the right direction, but we don't think it goes far enough. They have decided to allow their members, the boys who are openly gay, to be members. However, the ban still exists on atheists as well as adult scout leaders. And we believe discrimination is discrimination. It doesn't stop at children. We think that they should end their policy of discrimination for all people from the Boy Scouts.
And what about religious belief? Is that something that Boy Scouts actually discriminate on?
Oh, absolutely. Their bylaws stipulate that you have to believe in a higher power. So this is discriminatory against atheists and humanists and others who do not profess an absolute belief in God. And one of the arguments that we hear from the Boy Scouts is that it's a private organization, yet they do accept some federal funding through various different means, whether it's through brick-and-mortar use of buildings or, you know, many other ways. They're accepting federal funding. And any organization that accepts public dollars should not be able to discriminate against Americans using taxpayer dollars.
And what about the continued ban on gay leaders in the Boy Scouts? Is that something your group is opposing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we oppose discrimination in all forms. And, you know, if they were excluding people who were religious, we would oppose that as well. You know, we're anti-discrimination. And in this case, it happens to be discrimination against non-believers and against people who come from the LGBT community. I mean, we're don't get me wrong. We're happy that they have, agreed to include boys who are openly gay. We think it's a step in the right direction, but it does not go far enough. Our laws are written, they're secular laws, they're written by lawmakers who are elected for and by the people. They're not written by clergy. There's so many different indicators. I mean, even in documents such as the Treaty of Tripoli, which was signed in, I think, 1787. Again, I don't have my papers in front of me, but it states explicitly the United States is in no way a Christian country. So we've seen a movement to kind of rewrite history. We have, you know, revisionist historians who are selling a certain message. But the reality is that when we see things like "In God We Trust" on our money and "Under God and the Pledge," people are under the impression that that type of stuff has always been there, when in reality it wasn't added until the 1950s. So this is not something that that our founders intended. This is something that was added later. And what we really want to do is return these type of things to the intent that the founders had for us. We want to make sure that there's a strong separation of religion and government. And that's not just to protect atheists or agnostics or others who don't have that absolute belief in God. It's to really to protect all of us, including religious people. Many religious people don't realize that the separation of church and state protects them as well.
Well, thanks very much. Again, I've been speaking with Lauren Anderson Youngblood, who's with the Secular Coalition for America, an organization that serves as the national lobby for atheists, agnostics, humanists, freethinkers, and other non-theistic Americans. Their website, secular.org. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Northeastern California experienced a 5.7 magnitude earthquake yesterday, which, according to the U.S. Geological Survey, was felt as far away as San Francisco, Nevada, and Oregon. There are no reported injuries from the earthquake, which was centered in rural Greenville, California. A 4.9 aftershock occurred at 1 a.m. this morning, with dozens of other aftershocks following. Early field reports indicate that the 5.7 jolt did not cause serious damage.
A Native American activist was arrested today for trying to file a complaint to a Nebraska government office about liquor sales to Native Americans outside the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. The incident took place in White Clay, an unincorporated village of 14 people in northwest Nebraska bordering the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, which consists mainly of liquor shops targeting Native Americans who live on the reservation. White Clay lies on disputed land, 200 feet from the official reservation border and less than 2 miles from the center of Pine Ridge, South Dakota. Sale and possession of alcoholic beverages in Pine Ridge is prohibited under tribal law, except for a brief experiment with on-reservation liquor sales in the early 1970s. This prohibition has been in effect since the reservation lands were created. White Clay has 4 off-sale beer stores licensed by the state of Nebraska. These stores sell the equivalent of 4.5 million cans of beer annually, or over 12,000 a day, to the 28,000 Oglala Sioux living in Pine Ridge. Activists have organized campaigns beginning last year to shut down the White Deer liquor stores. T.R. McKenzie, a member of the group Deep Green Resistance, was arrested today in the state office building just minutes before he planned to file a complaint with the Nebraska Liquor Control Commission.
The labor advocacy group Our Walmart has filed 30 complaints with the National Labor Relations Board against the giant retail company. The complaints were filed on the same day as the release of Business Insider's list of America's 12 worst supermarkets. Walmart ranks as the second worst supermarket in the U.S. The Walton family's massive chain is the only national store on the list.
British banking giant HSBC discovered last year to have conducted billions of dollars of illegal transactions with drug lords, so-called terrorists, and individuals within dictatorial regimes like Myanmar and Libya may face criminal prosecution after the breakdown of a settlement deal. U.S. justice officials have previously offered a controversial $1.9 billion buyoff deal in which HSBC could receive immunity from criminal prosecution in exchange for cash. Under the terms of the agreement, known as a deferred prosecution agreement, all criminal charges were to be set aside if the bank complied with the terms, which included the institution of new compliance measures. The failure to criminally prosecute an entity that had facilitated such a high degree of profit from violent and illegal industries led many, including U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, to question a policy of considering banks, quote, too big to jail. Analyst Jim Santos of Mizuho Securities referred to the settlement costs as trivial in light of the company's profits. Judge John Gleason, a former assistant attorney general who secured the conviction of crime boss John Gotti, is currently withholding his signature on the $1.9 billion DPA deal. While the Justice Department is challenging the need for his approval, the dispute is ongoing. If Gleason rejects the deal, HSBC will face criminal prosecution and a new threat that its charter to do business in the United States will be revoked.
According to a report by NBC reporter Michael Isikoff, Attorney General Eric Holder signed the search warrant ordering the Justice Department to search the emails of a Fox News reporter. The warrant approved by Eric Holder named Fox News reporter James Rosen as a co-conspirator and approved the tracking of Rosen's communications with his source, Stephen Kim. Kim is accused of leaking classified information about North Korea to the media. Holder told NBR in early May that he was not sure how many times he had authorized the searching of journalist records.
I'm not sure how many of those cases that I have actually signed off on. I take them very seriously. I know that I have refused to sign a few, pushed a few back for modifications.
The warrant issued by Holder has caused concern about the potential criminalization of investigative journalism. Currently, government officials require no approval to access journalists' email. This appears to be a loophole in a law which requires the Attorney General's approval to search journalists' phone records, mail, and other materials. President Obama has ordered the Attorney General to investigate current guidelines used by the Department of Justice when investigating leaks.
Before leaving for a week-long Memorial Day vacation, the Senate voted down a proposal to allow states to require the labeling of genetically modified products. Senate Republicans also blocked a vote on repealing a provision passed earlier this year that prevents federal courts from halting the sale and planting of genetically modified seeds, even if there are environmental or health concerns. On Capitol Hill, SFRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Activists in Buenos Aires, Vancouver, Copenhagen, Chicago, and more than 300 other cities will take to the streets on Saturday to call attention to the impact of Monsanto's products. The action in Washington, D.C. will feature a die-in in front of the White House to represent the harm to bees from Monsanto's pesticide Roundup and the plants genetically modified to withstand it. Marchers will also target the Food and Drug Administration and other federal agencies they say have enabled the company to profit at the expense of the environment and human health. Many environmental scientists, including Patty Lavera with the organization Food and Water Watch, criticized the FDA for approving genetically modified corn, soybeans, sugar beets, and other crops to be sold to the U.S. public, but ignoring several petitions over the past 20 years to require these products to be clearly labeled in supermarkets.
They made a decision in the mid-90s. They wrote a memo that said, we think these foods are the same. We think genetically engineered foods are the same, and you shouldn't have to label them. And we think that was just the wrong decision, and we've been living with the consequences of that ever since.
Lavera and other food safety advocates also point to the so-called revolving door between government and powerful corporations as a factor in this decision. David Murphy with the organization Food Democracy Now! Said the most egregious example is FDA official Michael Taylor.
He's currently the second in command, the Deputy Food Commissioner of Food. He's otherwise known as a food czar. Now, Michael Taylor made his name as a Monsanto attorney who was regularly rotated in and out of Monsanto's law offices and executive offices into the Food and Drug Administration and the USDA. Michael Taylor is a lawyer cleverly crafted that basically has allowed Monsanto's products to be sold in the U.S. unlabeled for 20 years.
Bills are currently advancing in Vermont, Connecticut, Maine, and Washington state to mandate the labeling of genetically modified foods, and a ballot initiative in California was narrowly defeated last November. But Vermont independent Bernie Sanders says large agribusiness corporations like Monsanto have threatened to sue his state and others for attempting to pass such laws, arguing that food labeling rules have to come from the federal government. His amendment to the Farm Bill, which the Senate rejected 71-27 on Thursday, would have made such legal threats invalid.
Throughout Europe and in dozens of other countries around the world, this exists. It is not a very radical concept. It exists throughout the European Union, and I believe very simply that states in this country should be able to go forward in labeling genetically modified foods if that is what they want.
All Senate Republicans voted against the measure, along with several Democrats. Michigan Democrat and lead Farm Bill author Debbie Stabenow argued that the Sanders Amendment would interfere with the Food and Drug Administration's process for determining what kind of food labeling is necessary. But Sanders said it's about consumer rights, not federal agency rights.
Do the American people have a right to know what they are eating, what is in the food that they are ingesting and what their kids are eating?
Amidst hours of debate this week on the bill to set the nation's agriculture policy for the next 5 years, the Senate also refused to take up an amendment to repeal what food safety advocates call the Monsanto Protection Act. That provision was tacked on to the continuing resolution to keep the government funded that was hurriedly passed in March with little debate. Oregon Democrat Jeff Merkley explained why he is now leading the effort to repeal it.
This legislation does something that I think most would find astounding. It allows the unrestricted sale and planting of new variants of genetically modified seeds that a court has ruled have not been properly examined for their effect on other farmers, the environment, and human health.
Because all 100 senators have to unanimously agree to consider an amendment before it gets a vote, an objection from just one lawmaker, Missouri Republican Roy Blunt, blocked Merkley's proposal. But he plans to reintroduce the amendment when the Senate resumes debate on the Farm Bill in late June. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley announced plans for a new amendment that will hopefully override the Farmer Assurance Provision, otherwise known as the Monsanto Protection Act. Locally, several groups are organizing a march tomorrow morning to participate in the National Day of Action called Millions Against Monsanto. They will meet at Holiday Park in front of the Lloyd Center in Northeast Portland tomorrow at 11. Here are the voices of some of the people who called in to KBOO this morning to speak with organizers about the march.
I went on your Facebook page yesterday and saw there were 4,000 people signed up to attend the march. So yeah. I don't know.
It's over 4,400 now. 4,400. I'm sorry, there's over 4,400 now.
Yeah, so that's just jaw-dropping. That's going to be a great Saturday. I can't wait. And so I'm going to come, and I want to encourage everybody else to show up, and anybody that's been involved in Clean Water Portland. I mean, maybe we ought to have Clean Food Portland, just keep it rolling.
Yeah.
Because nice. It's just as insidious to have these things put into our food supplies as having it put into our water. And it's bigger because it's global, but the same insult to everybody here. So I hope everyone shows up.
One thing that's, in talking about how farmers don't really seem to have any protections or rights, I think this is why we were seeing on the East Coast, is a little underreported in the corporate media, understandably. But, in Pennsylvania, with the organizing of the program on corporations, law, and democracy, POCLAD, where they started a community rights-based ordinance program, right? And these rural conservative communities were drafting ordinances, legally binding ordinances, that said, first of all, corporations are not people, and second of all, nature has a right to exist and to flourish. And on the basis of those two points, that puts the corporations on the defensive, and they have to justify their activities instead of us having to justify why it's not okay for genetically modified pollen to blow onto our organic crops. And Paul Cienfuegos is really working hard here in Portland to build community rights-based legislation in local communities all throughout the state. And so I highly recommend folks get on